Meandering in the margins of medicine, it's the Short Code Podcast.
Greetings, and welcome back to the Short Code Podcast. I'm Dave Etler, and I'm keyed up right now, filled with nervous anticipation as I contemplate what I'm about to do. As I sit on the edge of my seat, I proudly proclaim that Cole Chaney, Lisa Weir, and Greg Woods have joined me today in the Bulware community comfy chairs to engage in what I'm certain will be a historic discussion of current thought from the margins of medicine.
I feel a little left out. I don't have a comfy chair here.
I don't either. It turned out that people were on the actual comfy couches when we came in. But now they're all gone, so I should have just kicked them out.
That was the Dave intro we've been waiting for.
Cole, Dave, I was thinking...
Did you write this?
I was thinking of Cole this morning as I wrote, because maybe not the last podcast, the one before,
he was on you a little bit.
Was he? Yeah. He's like,
Dave said, hi, welcome to the Short Coat.
He's like, Dave, that's it. That was terrible.
It read like a David Foster Wallace novel the one time you came in, you know, it was just eloquent, and there's words like flowery.
I don't know if I matched that today, but I was thinking of you, Cole, when I wrote this. So welcome to the show, guys. Welcome back to the show.
Thanks, Dave. Woo-hoo.
So what's going on?
So I have a life philosophy discussion today.
Oh, I don't know. Is this a good idea?
Is it
a good idea to think so closely about our lives? I mean, shouldn't we just...
No, we should never look back. All right. I totally agree with that.
All right.
Introspection. No, just
Perfection.
Get out your angry birds.
Overrated.
And don't think about what happened today. So here's the thought. Principles of infectious disease exam today, right? So I'm cruising through this exam and it's going really well. And I'm getting every single question about ADP ribosylation and these tiny little sub-strain serotype of bacteria. And then I get to the question that asks, what is the most common STI in America? And I am stumped, right? Stumped. And then when you think about what it comes to as a physician, like what matters?
Mm-hmm.
Does it matter if a patient comes in, I can explain to them how their pertussis toxin has an FHA agglutinating toxin? Or does it matter if the person comes in, I can say, you know, it's most likely chlamydia and probably not syphilis or gonorrhea or other things? And I realize this is a bigger discussion, perhaps even beyond med school, of seeing the forest from the trees instead of staring at the bark on the tree in front of you.
You guys have to do a lot of bark staring.
Yeah, and you lose
it. That's a good description, too.
Yeah. Bark staring.
Yeah, bark staring. I like
that. The beetles.
And this feeds in because Dave wanted to discuss...
Beetles crawling on the bark.
They're important. Dave wanted to discuss medical mnemonics, and I realized that maybe some of the bark staring feeds into this mnemonic game where you just literally memorize words instead of concepts and ideas.
Yeah, I ran across this article by a psychiatrist at Columbia University, Anne Skomorowski, who noted that Peter of Ravenna, a 15th century writer and mnemonist, I didn't even know there were such things, but somebody who
put that on your job description, I like that,
mnemonizes, I don't know, argued that students should excite their memories by using images of beautiful virgins to assist their recollection.
Well, med students certainly went there.
Beautiful, yes. Yeah, I've heard a few mnemonics and they're usually pretty tame because I'm usually sitting in a meeting with educators and deans and people like that, and nobody's willing to come up with the real mnemonic that they probably use.
The virgins wouldn't have helped you with the STI question then, I assume.
No. Ironically enough.
No. Worth a try.
So yeah, there's a good bit of bark staring here, and if you're offended by graphic mental images and thinly veiled but somehow still sexually explicit verbiage, now's the time to skip this episode. So here are, and I'm gonna try to gloss over the more salacious words if I can, which kind of defeats the point of a mnemonic, but you can imagine. Here are a couple of mnemonics that Skomorowski claims are common. We'll see if you can recall anything. Oh, 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 to touch and feel a girl's... heaven.
Crayoners.
Yes, yes. Some say marry money, but my brother says big matters most.
The functions of the cranial nerves.
Yes, whether a given cranial nerve is motor sensory or both. I'll just tell you that this is another cranial nerve.
A lot of cranial nerve today.
Man.
There are 12 of them.
And can't see, can't pee, can't climb a tree.
Oh, I do remember
that. What's that one?
I don't remember what it is, but I remember.
I've heard that.
Wasn't a very helpful mnemonic to you then.
No, not well. At the time it was, but.
So that's Ryder's syndrome, which is related to sexually transmitted disease. I'm in that mode right now. What's yours, Dave?
I don't know if I should say this one.
Oh, come on, do it.
What are some other ones you guys can think of?
On occasion, Oliver tries to blank blank various guys.
Oh, that's cranial nerve again.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, anytime it was
blanks our history.
That one wasn't very useful.
I know, it wasn't at all. I just want to say the words, but I can't. Toilet paper, my ass. Feel a little bit better about saying that.
Oh, one. That's the, isn't that the heart?
Valves of the heart.
Yeah.
Oh, in the order of blood. I've never heard that one. In the order of blood flow.
Huh.
TPMA.
Yeah.
Instead of, there's always party till midnight.
Always party till midnight. Yeah. That's for listening, though. But the order the blood actually flows, that would be that one.
Huh.
Which I've never heard, but.
Some lovers try positions they cannot handle.
That's the favorite.
The hand bones. You know, I never really liked that one, though, because I could never remember which direction I was going. So I always use the pinky one. So long to pinky, here comes the thumb. And then I know I'm at the pinky or the thumb.
Let's see. Tips for triple orgasm. Tonight, take approximately 4 Viagra. Good vodka still helps.
What's that one?
No one?
I don't know that one.
Say it again.
Tips for a triple orgasm. Tonight, take approximately 4 Viagra. Good vodka still helps.
Is that the cranial nerves again?
It is.
Again.
Triple orgasm, oh.
Yeah, you're
right.
Okay.
Yeah.
Susie tastes like sweet apple pie.
I don't know, Dave.
These are the branches of the axillary artery.
Steven Tyler.
Oh, yes.
Plays guitar.
Something like that.
Yeah.
So,
I think they stress these much less.
Well, my question is.
Pizzamenti actually really doesn't like mnemonics. He says they teach you to just rotely memorize and not really understand.
It's basically cramming because.
It is.
You know, maybe cramming in a more efficient way, but.
Yeah.
You're unable in a lot of these mnemonics to look at the problem from different angles.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're presented the question in the context of the mnemonic in that order, you got it.
Yeah.
But as soon as they change things up, that's where it gets really messy.
And they love to change things up in med school.
That's the whole point.
Yeah.
And you're right. I guess when you're dealing with a patient, explaining to them what the relationship is between triple orgasms and, you know, their Bell's palsy probably isn't going to probably isn't going to help you very much, right?
Yeah. I was thinking about this an app the other day for lecture slides. I don't know how I would invent this, but one of the classes, basically every single disease had fever associated with it. And at a certain point, I realized I don't want to read the word fever anymore because I think I focus on it. Like, I don't even want to see it so that it's not a distinguishing characteristic. And so this app would basically look for anything that shows up in 70%+, and then it would just delete it. And then if it didn't show up, it's like this is a super sophisticated AI app that essentially takes care of redundancy. Like, arthritis comes up in a lot of diseases, like every autoimmune to one. So then at a certain point, I don't want to see it on my slides anymore.
You know what you could do is somehow data mine WebMD.
Okay.
For, you know, like when I'm ill, I will go to WebMD and search for my symptoms, and what I invariably will find is that I have cancer. So that would be something to data mine to come up with those, you know, symptoms that are just
like buzzword,
low yield,
myalgia.
Yeah.
Everyone's tired.
Yeah.
Like that's
the problem becomes when you have one of the only one that doesn't have arthritis, and you just read over and think, well, it's not there, so it must have been deleted.
Yeah, and that's a huge clinical finding.
Yeah.
You know, this makes me think of, I had a teacher in high school who hated highlighting because he was like, people would just go through the books and they just highlight things and they think they're learning it because they're highlighting it when they really aren't. So he would be if you were in his class and you had your notes out, he wouldn't let you highlight, but he would let you have a black marker and you could, cross out and you had to black out things that you didn't think, because then he's like, you think really hard about what you don't ever want to see again. So I always think about that when I'm in class and highlighting things, because I
blew my mind.
I highlight very, very little, but I think about it because there are some times where I'm like, you know, it actually would be really probably helpful for me to, I mean, I use an iPad and I would probably white things out so they would blend into the background, but like to white some of this stuff out because it's just extraneous information.
Or you know it already.
And then it's one less thing that I like going through the notes have to be like, oh yeah. So
the filter.
It's very counterintuitive. I feel like, you know, you're eliminating knowledge.
I think that's the intent, though.
By doing that.
It strikes me as just wrong. In med school, you know, trying to parse through, all right, what do I need to know for this? What don't I need to know? Which is also kind of getting at Cole's original life lesson there of, you know, do I need to know this or not? That mentality is kind of forced upon us in med school a lot of times.
I mean, because it's impossible to know everything.
Yeah.
Like, you just can't.
And you want to see a professor roll their eyes, ask them if you need to know it.
Yeah, yeah. Exactly.
You know, this comes up so often. You know, I'm on the Medical Arts and Sciences Committee, which basically means I take their minutes. And, which is fine. But what I've noticed is that students are always going on about, you know, their frustration with the fact that they don't know what it is they need to know for the exam, which of course really seems to set everybody else's teeth on edge in the room. But you know, I don't know.
The problem is the occasional professor that will say, I actually inserted this chart just for your reference. And like, you need to make a big explicit note, because if you don't, all of a sudden you find yourself staring at this page of information.
Have you seen the video that's like the ultimate med school lecture?
No.
Yes. Yeah.
It's pretty good.
Does it have a lot of that?
It does cover a lot of that stuff. Yeah. Yeah.
It was like, this is just for reference. You don't need to know this like five times.
Maybe you can send that and I'll...
I'll have to send you the link.
I do appreciate the ones that are very explicit with that. They put like a little icon or something on the page, like a little star, and say, all right, this marks the ones that you don't need to know. So I'm just putting this in there. Don't worry about memorizing it. It's crazy. But you always get the inevitable joke, oh, I'm going to make you memorize everything about that. That's not funny anymore. Maybe the first time people laugh, but after, you know, like the 9th or 10th time that different professors do that, everybody just kind of sits there and goes, mm-hmm.
Laugh, laugh, laugh.
Yep. It's good.
This is a bit meta.
That's today's show.
I was thinking about a future episode, and last year we did a technology show?
It was.
Should we do another one?
That could be fun. I mean, technology changes a lot.
Yeah, okay. We'll do that.
Someone needs to get Google glasses here at the university.
Oh.
Then I think that'd be the ultimate tech show.
Can we get one for the short coat and write it off?
It'd be so cool.
Business expense.
You know what I have coming today?
Google
Glass.
A new
iPad? I just got one.
I was hoping it'd be Google Glass.
2 days ago.
Yes. I'm very excited because
What's the new one?
The iPad Air 2.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
I will be probably using it feverishly all weekend, because this iPad that I have here in front of me has outlived its.
That's how mine was.
Its usefulness.
Yeah.
Well, what does an iPad? I feel like it doesn't get slower like a laptop. Does
it?
Do. Oh, it actually does.
With the latest iOS update, it destroyed my iPad. It destroyed my iPad's ability to function as a useful tool.
We both had the iPad 2, right?
Yes.
Yeah, I had an iPad 2 that I've had since I started my master's degree. So it's, I think, 4 years old now. Mm-hmm. And iOS 8 just killed it. Notability crashed in class at least once a time in class.
That's stressful.
I couldn't use my anatomy app anymore. Like, worthless, and then just things, and it was so slow.
And you know, I don't even use this for like, you know, studying mission critical stuff like you guys would, but you know, like when I'm at home and I'm trying to take the latest BuzzFeed quiz on what kind of dog I am, you know, I don't want to be faced with crashes.
You shouldn't have to put up with that.
Exactly. Thank you.
This is by design by Apple, right?
Conspiracy theorists would say yes.
It's just
4 years old. I mean, let's face it, it's 4 years old.
Is the processor that much different?
It is. And the Retina display, holy cow, I thought that was overrated. Okay. And I have the iPad mini now. I decided to go with the smaller one. And holy cow.
Yeah, this one supposedly has Retina. And yeah, it is pretty cool.
Okay. I think what happened is they added, it's not so much that they, you know, they added so many new features to the OS, like background updates and, you know, all kinds of fanciness, but they didn't necessarily allow you an easy way to not take advantage of them. So it's basically doing all this crap in the background that it can't handle anymore.
Well, then you also have to think about, you know, apps have been getting more and more processor intensive because processors are bigger. So the apps are bigger. They use more processing power, and you get enough of those apps doing that, and it just is not prepared for it.
And then on top of that, you get U2 albums being downloaded to your iPad. It's terrible.
That was nuts. I'm sorry. I don't understand where they
that was generational, though.
That's what I've heard. Yeah.
I just get the sense that generationally, an older generation treasures an album. First of all, an album means something, and secondly, they treasure you too. And our generation does not appreciate either.
Whoa!
Hey, don't speak too harshly.
I have a vinyl collection. Thank you. I appreciate the album.
I'm speaking for our generation. I think.
But yeah,
us three may be like you too. Older you too.
Older you too.
But would you say overall that
this
is part of the, I think my dad would be very pumped to have a brand new U2 album on his iTunes. So I don't think he'd be upset about it.
You know, I read recently that that Bono's ridiculous glasses are because he has glaucoma.
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
Yeah, he had alluded to that years ago, but he just came right out and said it in an interview. I want to say, I don't remember if it was BBC or ITV.
It's pretty recent.
It was just a couple weeks ago where he said, well, the reason is every time there's a flash on a camera, I see it for hours afterward. He said it hurts. So part of it is a little bit vanity, he said, but
I guess if you were going to have to wear glasses all the time, wear, you know, shades all the time, mm-hmm. you might want them to look somewhat distinctive. Then you were a rock star, you know.
Like when you're in the White House and you got your...
Yeah.
Cool shades on.
Yeah. So I guess he's not as big of a...
Which is more vanity? Scarves on stage or like sunglasses on stage?
Well...
Just the Aerosmith.
Maybe if you're covering up your trach hole, then, you know, then maybe a scarf on stage would be...
Well, well,
would be...
I didn't see it going there.
So scarves are permissible at night, whereas sunglasses... Yeah. That says something about you.
Say it's a balmy 85 out. And it's dark.
That also says something. Now, both at night?
Yeah, so which is more vain? We got Steven Tyler and we got Bono. You know, one scarf master, one sunglasses master.
Scarf master.
I like scarves.
They're okay.
I have to say with it, yeah.
We'll be back in just a second on the Short Coat Podcast.
Inside Stories is an oral narratives project that catalogs the stories of medical students during their journeys through medical school. The podcast is hosted on In Training, the online magazine for medical students. Visit us at in-training.org/inside-stories. Inside Stories is a founding member of Vocalis, the podcast network for medical students. Please listen to our partner podcasts at vocalisnetwork.wix.com/listen.
Welcome back.
All right. Three of us here, at least, are guys. And I imagine that in our lives, we have experienced being called...
Which three?
I'll let you decide.
I had a brief moment where I was like, I'm not a guy.
I'm sorry, Lisa. I didn't want to break it to you this way. No, in our lives, you know, we've probably been called, you know, numbskulls, blockheads, thick skulled, things like that.
Dumb.
I mean, you name it. We're kind of used to it right now.
And that's just this morning.
Yeah, and we absorb those blows. But now you may be interested in knowing that there is an evolutionary basis for how we are able to be so thick-skulled.
Oh, thank God. I'm so relieved.
I know. I was waiting for this news for many, many years to come out to confirm this, but now it has. In Biological Reviews, they came out with a study that said there may be an evolutionary basis to the thickening of our skulls over time, just in males. Now, apparently, if you think back to our long-ago ancestors who roamed the savannah, or however you want to take it, they did a lot of expected things, you know, hunting, fishing, reproducing, living in caves, but also apparently hitting each other in the face was very common because they found that at some point, despite eating the exact same diet, the males began to develop much thicker skulls than the females did at that time. And they think that that's because they liked to fight.
So basically you're saying you're like mountain goats.
No, I'm saying we're like a prehistoric fight club where you can't grunt about Fight Club. This is something that they've speculated a long time about because there were arguments that, well, maybe the structure of the hands, they weren't actually able to close their hands into a fist, so how are they able to fight with each other? But apparently there were...
They just use their faces.
Well, that could be. All right, then we are like mountain goats.
Is this self-selected then for... bonier
over time, yes, to absorb that so you don't go crazy so they think that this, you know, this goes back 2 million, 4 million years ago, and it kind of keeps going through today, that males tend to have a little bit thicker skulls. So there you go, that's the reason why.
I have a corollary on this. I got my blood drawn the other day and also a number of shots, and I'm very, very queasy about this. And ever since I was a little boy, I would just, as soon as I'd stand up, I'd pass out immediately after. And now I've known the nurse, I tell the nurse in advance, I have a special way I lay, I eat special, like I eat candy while I do it, and it really helps a lot. And I was looking into this.
A special way.
It's like, seriously.
Oh, God.
It's a process. It takes like half an hour per shot. But then, so I was looking into this, and there's a strong genetic component. So they've tracked it. Families really have a strong trend. It's not just this psychosomatic thing that we think. They actually think there's a biological basis for this. And it's facilitated by accelerated heart, and then just your blood pressure drops the second that shot goes in and the person passes out. So the theorized reason for this evolutionarily is that this is a strong beta male trait, in that alpha male alpha male attacks you. Okay, alpha male draws blood. The entire species can't survive if it's all alpha males fighting each other, so it needs to have beta male essentially.
That is brilliant.
He plays dead as soon as he sees blood.
So they may actually look into this, because their plans to confirm a lot of this is to take current great apes and see their postures in how they fight. So they want to see, is it possible that there were blows to the head, and how do they, you know, is it common for them to hit each other in the face, things like that. So believe it or not, it sounds like they're actually just going to have, like, apes go into Mortal Kombat or
Chimps
something.
Chimps always go for the eyes. That's what you do.
Ethical conflict.
Well,
there.
I think it is, because they haven't really said how they're going to do it, but they said maybe they'll model some of this, but otherwise they said they will next examine the foot posture of great apes with combat in mind. And that's as far as they went into it.
I just want to point out that we're joined by Zijiang.
Hello. Hello, everyone.
Hi.
So when did you switch? Did this start at 12?
We're sort of going back and forth because the M1s and the M2s have different lunch hours.
That's why.
Switch it up so you don't climb.
I've been foiled again.
That's all right. That's all right. We're glad to have you here for any part of this.
Thanks for having me, guys.
Oh, she sounds so sad.
I am sad. I've missed out on the beginning of this chimp conversation. And. But I'm glad I got to hear about Cole's beta male response
beta male
trade. To shots.
Yeah.
Interesting. I'm surprised by this story. British man faked quadriplegia and coma for 2 years to avoid going to court. This makes me wonder, aren't there like doctors out there who can, I don't know, is there not like a test?
Wait, I was going to say, how do you fake a coma for 2 years? I would be so bored.
He stole like, more than 40,000 pounds from the bank account of an elderly neighbor with Alzheimer's. When police started looking into it, he claimed he was a quadriplegic and so sick that he sometimes fell into a coma.
Oh my.
The suspect's wife was in on it, claimed she had to care for him after he broke his neck in a fall as he pulled down the garage door, blah, 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 blah. Unfortunately, he was caught on camera in a grocery store shopping after police noticed that his loyalty card was being used. And then each time the police tried to bring him to court, he checked himself into the hospital. Is that even possible? Do you just go to the hospital and be like, hey, I'm gonna fall into a coma
here pretty soon.
Anyway.
Sounds like the beta male trait resurfacing. Approached by the law, he's going to play quadriplegic.
Maybe he could claim that every time he got injured out working, he would just faint and then...
It's evolution at work, right?
It's evolution.
There.
It's not I can't help it.
Anyway, court finally decided to proceed without him, because even though he showed up in court in a wheelchair and a neck brace, and he admitted theft and forgery charges, he's facing jail time.
So. Is there a legal implication for feigning medical illness? Is there a...
I guess it would depend on how he did it, because if he went to the hospital and tried to get all of the, you know, the money and the care from them all this time, that's one thing. But if he just like fell into a coma at home, which is how he may have been able to get away with this and go shopping and all this other stuff, then maybe not. I mean, obviously there are implications for, you know, skipping out on court and things, but.
I fall into a coma all the time. It's nothing to do with me bilking people out of it. It's just more or less what I do after dinner.
Or when he's working on our MSP letters.
Oh, my God.
Explain what that means for the listeners.
Medical student... Whoa. Sorry. Medical student performance evaluations.
I'm starting.
I know. I was just going to do it again.
And so what are these letters used for?
These are the letters that... these are the evaluations that go to programs. I go to residency programs during the application process when M4s are seeking residency, and they sort of don't look at them, as far as I can tell.
Pretty much.
You know, like...
The residency programs or the students?
The residency programs. The students, oh my God, the students are like... The students think they're like the worst, the most important thing ever, but I can tell you that according to research, it is the very last...
According to
what I've read,
research.
it's the very least important thing that programs in general look at. Now, of course, it's going to vary from program to program, but in general, it is the least most important.
I still think one of these days you need to share kind of the choiciest evaluations that we get. Some of them are just hilarious.
Don't you think about that once?
I know. I was going to, and I chickened out because I don't want to offend people. I don't want to offend students who might be upset that I was, you know, I'm not going to use their names or anything like that, but you know, they might be upset that I was sort of sharing this FERPA protected information.
I was going to say we don't have listeners, but we apparently do.
We do.
We did anyone call in this week?
That's true. No, nobody called.
No questions? Oh,
tweets.
People,
I want your tweets.
Yeah.
Tweets, I know.
It's hip. It's easy.
Yeah, it's easy.
And it's limited to 160 characters, so it's short.
So it's, you know, that's really hard.
160?
140. Oh, right.
That would cause an uproar.
They save 20 for that. If they suddenly... the SMS something, something.
Oh, man, yeah.
Oh, man.
People would freak out.
All right, I have
a big deal.
I have the necessary Ebola story of the week.
Yeah.
But it's Iowa-centric, so we're going to go with it.
Sweet. Not bad.
Ebola in Iowa?
None. Okay. So, an Iowa high school student planning a mission trip to Uganda has agreed to stay in isolation for 21 days following their return from the trip. That's about all the story is. Not a lot of fight. But I thought it was interesting that now you have to... I mean, part of me is if I were a high school student, I was like, I don't have to go to school for 21 days. That'd be kind of nice. But yeah, I thought it was an interesting thing. I'm not totally sure of how the isolation will work. You know, is it a confinement? Do you slide the food under the thing? Is there a robot? I don't really understand it. But
I hope there's a robot.
There was a robot, right?
Well, they've been talking about that this week, saying, how can we adapt our robot force to treat Ebola?
We have a robot force?
Yes. All right, so that's kind of what I thought, too. But then they explained it. The robots, for instance, that disarm bombs or that go in, you know, do things with cars, you know, opening the cars and stuff like that. So they're wondering, could we actually adapt some of these robots to go treat people, to disinfect stuff, to bury people if we need to, in all these different tasks that would involve human interface with the fluids that would cause Ebola, could we at some point start working on that?
It seems really easy because they're not doing surgery. They're doing things like delivering towels and food.
Right.
Which is something I think a robot could do now, right?
Roomba. Mm-hmm.
What?
Roomba.
DJ Roomba. Absolutely.
I have Ebola, but my floor really needs vacuumed.
So, by the way, the U.S. State Department says a level 3 travel warning, and this is something that necessitates an isolation, is for Liberia, Sierra Leone, and Guinea, countries in West Africa. And Uganda is in Central Africa, so this is sort of a ancillary isolation situation.
So he's just okay. Okay. So he didn't come into contact with anybody with Ebola, as far as
he's going there.
He's not there.
He's going.
He's agreed to it.
He's saying at the end of the trip.
So wait, that implies that somebody was like, "Well, you got to go into isolation anyway when you come back."
Yes.
Oh,
that's
okay.
That's a good idea.
I thought it was like his
choice. Get him to agree to it before
they let him go.
That's a really good idea.
Mm-hmm. I agree.
All right.
I think that cuts down
Dave
on hysteria
like it.
And things. But
Dave doesn't like it.
Dave, that's what are you thinking, Dave?
I just, you know...
Your brows are knitted together.
I just, you know, like, I'm on the side of the people who are like, look, this is really not a big concern. I mean,
it's true. It's not nearly as infectious.
You know, like, why are we...
Like
diabetes.
Flu, and it won't like, kill as many
like
people as
diabetes.
Flu.
I think we might want to go back to
people
the classroom.
That we affect, you know? Not infect, but affect.
Effect. Well, have you seen Z-Dog MD? Do you know who I'm talking about?
What the guy is that?
He does rap videos, like medical rap videos.
No,
and there are a lot
really?
Of times parodies of popular songs. So he just did an Ebola one that came out, I think yesterday, maybe. And it was like, too soon? But he's like, no, it's actually not too soon because he's like, there's too much hysteria around it in the United
exactly.
States because there are things that kill a lot more people that are a lot more infectious and we need to
exactly.
be a little more realistic about Ebola.
Exactly.
Hmm.
That's the reason why my brows are knit.
I thought it did have a high mortality rate.
It has a high mortality rate, but it's incredibly hard to catch, right?
Yeah, it's very hard to get.
I see.
I mean, you know, the only way you're going to get it is if you, I don't know, like the doctor who went around New York City and, you know, he bowled and went to, I don't know what he did. But basically he was traveling around in like Uber and all this kind mm-hmm. of stuff. And people are like a little freaked out by this. Like, how could he be traveling around the city with Ebola? And no, he didn't. First of all, he was not showing symptoms yet.
Yeah.
And
right.
so was not spreading it around.
And he was monitoring it too.
Yeah. And he was aware that this was a potential problem. And so as soon as he developed symptoms, he went into the hospital. Fine. He did exactly what he was supposed to do. And even if he was shedding virus, the only way he's going to infect somebody is if they like lick his saliva or other things that we won't mention, or if he bleeds or pukes on you, which he didn't do any of those things.
Good reason not to lick bowling balls.
Yeah. Or
public service announcement.
Or subway bars.
Railings. Yeah.
Railings.
It's got an AIDS hysteria feel to it.
Yeah. Because even I remember in the 90s, when AIDS was kind of like, it was just everywhere. Like, if people were hysterical about it, still are a little bit, but maybe less so now, I guess. So, well, the university, fortunately, the University of Exeter is on the job, creating new healthcare therapies. This is a university in the UK who claims they've discovered the thing that makes rotten eggs and flatulence smell bad is the key.
I thought it was sulfur.
I thought we knew
hydrogen
that.
Sulfide.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But they've created a new compound from it called AP39, which is probably better than fart smell.
What are they doing with it?
They target it in tiny amounts at the right places in cells.
I'd say it had to be really little because it's really lethal.
Well, it may be a key to treating things like stroke.
Would you say deadly?
Do we need to talk to Matt?
Oh, no. About this?
Whoa.
No, I was thinking hydrogen sulfide happens a lot in manure pits and people die from it.
Right.
In relatively small amounts.
Targeting it in tiny amounts in the right places in cells may be key to treating things like stroke, heart failure, diabetes, arthritis, dementia, and aging. Which sounds a lot like the acai berry thing, or what, the acai, or the acai.
That's outstanding.
Acai berry.
Let's not go there.
So if someone passes gas on your chest, this is not going to cure your heart disease.
I don't think so.
Even though it's pretty targeted. Oh,
if they
not targeted enough.
All these things are mediated by.
I didn't go to med school for this.
All these things are
mediated. Wait for the eBay black market. Farts in a jar.
The show that never aired. All these things, they say, are mediated by mitochondrial damage because these mitochondria determine whether cells live or die and regulate inflammation. Is that true? Is the University of Exeter on crack?
It's mitochondria?
You weren't even listening. mitochondria damage, or mitochondria mediate all of these illnesses, stroke, heart failure, diabetes, arthritis, dementia, and aging, because they determine whether cells live or die and regulate inflammation, quote unquote.
I don't know if they necessarily mediate all
there
those.
There are several things in there I'm not sure about.
Energy powerhouses.
Well, yeah, but they're pretty essential in terms of like cell apoptosis. Because if the mitochondria breaks
which
down,
for the Dave and the Dave in the audience, oh what does God, that mean?
Programmed cell death.
Okay.
When the cell decides, all right, I'm too damaged, I'm just going to kind of involute on myself. And that way you and that does play into inflammation, because if it doesn't go through apoptosis, then you can get inflammation. But normally, if it does it correctly, the body doesn't respond.
Well, apparently stressed cells treated with AP39 protect mitochondria and keep cells alive. Cardiovascular disease research shows that more than 80% of the powerhouse mitochondrial cells, this is like a direct quote from the thing, it's really poorly written. More than 80% of the powerhouse mitochondrial cells survive under otherwise highly destructive conditions if AP39 is administered. There was a whole conference in Kyoto, the third international conference on hydrogen sulfide in biology and medicine. That's very specific.
Sounds like a blast.
Can you imagine?
There are journals out there for everything.
Presented small-scale studies that showed in high blood pressure, AP39 reversed blood vessel stiffening and lowered blood pressure, and also dramatically improved mortality after a heart attack by slowing the heartbeat. So,
wow.
If your significant other, parent, somebody goes into, you know, has a heart attack, you know what to do.
On a somewhat similar note, this is another random bit of news that I just wanted to throw in here. This Russian guy was walking along a stream a while back and saw a bone sticking out of it, which so many stories start this way, I know. So he went and plucked it out and took it to a university, and they found out that it was around 45,000 years old, but it had really intact DNA in it. So what they were able to do is they were able to look at the DNA and look at certain structures in it. And one thing they determined was that around this time, ancient Europeans had been farming for about 5,000 years. So they had domesticated animals they probably did, but also farm animals from which they got milk. But they found out that 5,000 years after they started that, they were still lactose intolerant. So that hadn't developed yet to where we were used to drinking that large amount of milk from animals. So this actually puts a little bit of a date on us for when the common tolerance to lactose developed.
For when my love of whole milk was born, basically. I love whole milk.
Explain this
to me. My wife thinks it's disgusting.
Whole unpastorized milk.
Never tried that. Never
it's
tried
illegal
that.
In Iowa,
I know.
But it's good.
It's illegal
in Iowa. Is it like chunky?
No. Well, if it's not you have to shake it because it's not homogenous.
I can think of it like, you know, like
my
real.
My family has dairy cattle. Okay. Well, not for very much
it's
longer.
Not chunky?
It's just getting so thick. At a certain point, there has to be some thick coagulation
but you,
in there.
You take most of the. You let it sit for a while and take some of the cream curds off of it. Okay. Yeah.
The curds.
It's not curds
and whey. So here's my question. So babies were designed to take milk.
Yes.
To eat milk. Mm-hmm. My understanding of my loose understanding of
well
pediatrics.
Done.
Okay.
Confirmed.
I think you can.
What? So what changes in the human biome that the adult or mature human now is not meant to intake milk and lactose?
The gene that breaks down lactose is one of those like time sensitive ones that turns off at a certain age. It's kind of like, you know, you only have fetal hemoglobin until a few okay weeks after you're born, and then that gene turns off and you get adult hemoglobin. It's the same way with the lactose one.
And that happens at a certain age, and
roughly, yeah.
Biologically, most humans were maybe not meant to then take in any type of milk.
Yes.
Afterwards?
Generally, yeah.
Okay. And so where do they, this is sort of more of a stretch. Why did cow's milk become so popular? That's another.
The theory is because it's mostly.
Thank God we have a dairy cattle.
I know, right? Expert here. Yeah. The theory is it's mostly in Northern Europeans that have the ability to tolerate lactose after adolescence. And they're the ones that domesticated dairy cattle. And the theory is that if you had the ability to drink milk, then you are more likely to survive like harsh winters and famines. And it was just another food source that you could have. And so they survived more. They passed on their lactose tolerance. And
so even if you are lactose intolerant, there is still nutritional benefit to drinking milk. Is this a...
I mean, you can get everything
so,
but the
yeah
lactose out of it.
You
yeah
get sugar and the
yeah
vitamin...
Well, not the lactose see sugar.
But there's other sugars, I assume, or maybe not in cow's
milk. That's why they make so many different, you know, lactose-free milks.
Sure.
Almond milks and things like that. Yeah. Because, it is good in protein and a lot
calcium
of other things,
protein
too.
Magnesium.
And I would like to point out, I kind of mixed up two different studies here when I'm talking about this. Some of the things that they sampled, the bones that they sampled to corroborate with this were more recent than that. They were, you know, between 5,700 BC all the way up to, you know, a little bit before BC. So 800 or so during the Iron Age. But this 45,000-year-old bone was actually more, and I guess this kind of goes back to one of our earlier studies, more interesting because they were able to look and find a little bit of Neanderthal DNA in it as well. So that kind of helps pinpoint when the insertion of Neanderthal DNA into what is now the modern human genome began. That's there, also interesting. I mean, that was back in
go
the time when they were probably hitting each other in the faces. So
45,000 years.
With, yeah.
With perhaps that bone.
Who knows?
Yeah. That's pretty cool. I kept reading about olfaction this week.
Oh.
Is this connected to the hydrogen sulfide
studies? These things seem to come together. I'm not really sure how it
happens.
Serendipity. Yeah, mm-hmm. It's interesting. First of all, the New York Times reported that scientists have discovered that our skin features more than 15 kinds of receptors that we're used to thinking of as olfactory receptors. And over the last several years, they've discovered that odor receptors are actually all over the place in our bodies, including places like the liver, the heart, kidneys, and even sperm. They allow cells to sense what's happening in the environment. And now surgeons in Poland, the other thing I noticed, so that's just cool, you know. So, you could pass wind on somebody's, you know, chest and help them out. I think that's solid science. I think we can lay that.
You've heard it first here.
I think we lay that to rest at this point. And now surgeons in Poland and London report that a man injured in 2010 in a knife attack has regained motion and sensation after having cells from his olfactory bulb mm-hmm transplanted into his spine. To bridge the gap, they did what they often do, which is, harvest some nerves from a lower limb and put it in the gap. But then they added olfactory and sheathing cells in there. And about 4 months after the surgery, he began regaining motion and sensation.
That is incredible.
So I actually know somebody who's undergone a similar procedure to that. He had to go over to Europe to do it.
All the cool stuff happens in Europe.
Yeah, right? I know. And it's a very interesting field and something that I'm interested in. But he went over there. He was injured in a motorbike accident when he was a kid. And he's paralyzed from about the chest down. But after this procedure now, the sensation is slowly creeping its way down. So now it's about to his hips, which is really important because he is a race car driver as well. So he gets a lot of sensation about what the car is doing through his legs and through, you know, the places that the car is pressed up against him. So he went through that. It's a very difficult procedure. It's a very long rehab process afterwards. So it isn't just put it in and wait and then they pop back. You have to do a lot of stimulation on him to get him working again. But it shows some promise.
They didn't talk about the therapies that surrounded this procedure. So that makes me wonder, like, you know, this is not science here. I mean, this is an N of one, basically.
Yeah.
That's what they were careful to say, but they were also hyping it up pretty well.
Do you sacrifice your olfaction? Or are they able to take only a small number?
I thought they said in this one they took out one of the olfactory bulbs. So
you can still smell.
Took one out, put it in the blender.
I don't know if you smell as well, but maybe.
I mean, if you just take one,
yeah,
I could still smell.
Well, you could still smell, but I mean, you know, would it be as vivid? Would it be everything?
I don't know.
Follow-up question. What about, does anyone here know at all, what about olfaction nerves? Do they have certain neurotransmitters that are consistent with motor function?
They apparently, I'm going to reach back into my memory and retrieve a potentially erroneous fact, but apparently they are one of the few parts of the nervous system that regenerate.
Okay. Do they really? Mm. So, semi-related thing here. My older brother was in a really, really bad car accident my senior year of high school, you know, brain injury, whatnot. And really common in that is that you lose your sense of smell because there's like shear when your brain slides and it shears off your olfactory nerves. And he lost his sense of smell. I didn't know it was common until I came to med school and I was like, oh my God, that's why Neil can't smell. But do you think someday he'll be able to smell again?
I would say that my professional opinion is, God, I hope so. That would be.
I know.
Does it impact his life in a significant way?
He has to be really careful about drinking milk because he can't smell when it's gone bad. That's actually how he discovered he couldn't smell, is he went and poured a bowl of cereal with milk and went to eat it and was like, oh my God, this is terrible. And he couldn't smell that it was bad.
So we know that a sense of taste is intimately linked with olfaction.
Yeah. It doesn't seem to have. I mean, he likes really spicy things more than the rest of us in the family. I mean, I grew up in a Midwestern farm family, so we eat pretty bland food.
I've noticed that about the Midwest.
True. He eats a lot of really spicy chili and stuff that the rest of us don't. So I wonder if maybe that's
kinda makes sense. Yeah.
He seems to taste things okay, surprisingly.
Is he an auto condimentor?
What the hell is that?
That means this is a term that the hospitality industry uses for people who automatically season their food before even having tasted it.
I am.
No, I don't think so.
Okay.
My father is, yes.
It just looks better with a little pepper on top.
Pepper makes everything better.
It really looks, or like Parmesan cheese.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. I got no problem with that.
Like, pizza's hilarious when you really think about, like, I'm putting cheese on my cheese.
Especially when you buy the, like, pre-made. This is what we do in our house. We buy the pre-made pizza, you know, from the frozen section, and then we put stuff on top of it.
Yep.
It's like, what?
Right. That sounds fantastic.
It is fantastic.
Party at Dave's house.
All right.
I made mac and cheese last night and added cheese to it, so.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, that's good. The Velveeta that you melt in.
Well, I didn't have Velveeta.
That's not technically cheese.
It's American, darn it.
Cheese food.
Add cheese to everything, even cheese.
All right. Well, we're done for this week. Thank you so much for stopping by. I'm so miserable at this.
I even asked you about it beforehand.
Thanks for listening to the Short Code Podcast. Before we go, we'd like to invite you to tell us about your moment of truth. If something strange or wonderful happened to you, if you're annoyed or pleased about something, or if you'd like to say hi to that special basic science professor in your life, leave us a message at theshortcoat.com. Do follow us on Twitter, make Cole happy, so you can stay up to date on what's happening in the margins of medicine, and comment, you know, send us a message. It's cool. Message us at the Short Coat. The show is made possible by this strange world we live in, and a generous donation by Carver College of Medicine Student Government and the Writing and Humanities Program. Our executive producers are myself and Jason Lewis. Our opening theme is by Dude Skywalker, and our closing music is by C2C. Talk to you in 1 week.